another rebound and a crown by the Brock Ness Monster. Ooh, that would be Page of Who? Jim Bob Foley? Holy moly. How about the Tasmanian Slovenian with the stop, drop, and pop? Hippity hop to the King's Herald Barbershop.
You're listening to the King's Herald Show, a bi-weekly NBA podcast that covers all the ups and downs, ins and outs of your one and only Sacramento Kings. As always, I'm your host, Will Griffith, and with me today, writer for the King's Herald, my co-host, Tony Zipteris. Tony, how's it going?
Will, 14 games left in the season. It's going good. I'm ready for the playoffs to get here, though.
I agree with you there. He's a former Sacramento King head coach, GM color analyst, GM of a WNBA champion, Indiana Basketball Hall of Famer. It's the troop, writer, French Lick. Jerry, as always, it is an absolute pleasure to have you here today. How's it going?
Well, it's great to be with you guys again, as always, and really looking forward to this stretch drive. It is really in the West. We're getting playoff basketball before playoff basketball.
100%. We are down to the wire here with this being the penultimate episode of the Kings regular season, just 14 games to go, and the playoff and play-in race, it's tighter than a Bulls button-to-fly season, man. Three games separating the playoff safe sixth seed from the ninth seed. The Kings have gone 5-2 since last we spoke. They've beaten the Bucks and the Lakers, which always feels good. That might be the best back-to-back of the season. They take care of business against the lovely Grizzlies in overtime. They beat the Raptors pretty handily, and they eke out a very strong victory against the Orlando Magic. They had two losses in there with an incredibly physical Knicks squad. And that was kind of a bit of a moral victory type game, followed by a confounding loss to the Washington Wizards, because the Kings stay the Kings. Guys, we're going to get to speculating on the season's end and where the Kings might end up. But I think it's probably most pertinent to start with injury news, as this is going to 100% affect the Kings and their ability to win games. Kevin Huerter is done for the season after a dislocated shoulder and torn labrum. He suffered in the first quarter of the Memphis Grizzlies game after a swipe down on the arm from Desmond Bane. You two talk to me a little bit about how losing Huerter affects the Kings in their playoff run, would you?
Well, I definitely think it hurts them depth-wise, if nothing else. Obviously, the Kings bench is really a questionable part of the whole equation anyway, and now they're one man down. And, you know, I think a lot of us, including certainly myself, feel like the team is probably a little better with Keon Ellis playing as a starter. But, you know, certainly with Kevin, if available, he certainly would be a terrific reserve like he was in Atlanta in their Eastern Conference finalists. So, yeah, it's nothing positive about it.
No. Tony, how about you?
Yeah, in a weird way, it forced the Kings to finally pull the trigger on Keon Ellis, which I'm sure we'll talk about a lot on the podcast today, and that has been a revelation in their starting lineup. So the starters might not miss Kevin Huerter, but like Jerry said, depth-wise, this team, their bench is already injured. I mean, Trey Lyles has been out for a little bit of time here. Sasha Vazankov is out. Now you've got Kevin Huerter out. That's a lot of depth to be missing when your depth is already pretty questionable. So, you know, we'll see how it shakes out in the playoffs, but is he going to be missed? Yeah, he'll be missed definitely on the depth side.
Obviously, the labrum is one of those injuries that can take a while to heal, and we're not 100% sure on the timeline here, but how would a prolonged healing process affect the Kings' offseason plans this season?
Well, I think the Kings should have some very busy offseason plans regardless. Sure. That would be my take. Depends on maybe how the season ends and playoff ends and those sorts of things. But in my mind, you know, I think if we've learned anything that this team needs more talent, that other teams improved themselves more than did the Kings. And so that's, you know, if you want to move up or even stay the same, I think this team is going to have to get more talent.
Yeah, for me, Kevin Huerter was always someone who, well, Kevin Huerter, I guess I would throw Harrison Barnes in the same kind of bucket of player where the Kings have been sort of passively looking for upgrades just because those are the natural positions when you've got Fox, Sabonis, and Murray in your starting lineup. Will this hurt Herter's trade potential? Maybe. Teams might want to see him healthy. At the same time, he's a pretty known commodity who is young enough where you would expect him to return from this at some point. So it might hurt it a little bit, but honestly, I feel like Kevin Herter's play this season would have hurt his trade value just as much as an injury. This just adds to what was already kind of declining trade value, in my opinion. So the Kings may look to move him in the offseason regardless of how he comes back. And yeah, this is not great from an asset standpoint either. But I do think Herter, you know, he's a known shooter in this league. He should recover, and some team will take a shot on him. It's just a matter of what will Monty get as a return. It's kind of hard to predict right now.
Does this add any pressure to re-signing Malik Monk this offseason? I know we're all kind of like in like DEFCON 1 about re-signing Malik Monk, but does this injury just add a little bit of pressure to signing Malik Monk in the offseason?
I really don't know that it changes anything. I mean, you've got to sign Malik Monk. That's where I look at it. I mean, it makes no difference if 7 guys go down. You've got to sign Malik Monk.
Tony, are you in agreement there?
Yeah, under no circumstance is that not priority number one this offseason. And yeah, I don't think the Herter injury really changes that a whole lot.
Okay, so I want to stay on the topic of King shooting guards here. We'll go first with the guy that last podcast we all felt should be getting more minutes. Suddenly the kid's averaging 28.8 minutes in the last 7 games, 2.3 steals, 1.3 blocks, almost 8.5 points. In a 2-game span, we had a game where he got 5 blocks. Then he followed that up with a game with 4 steals. I am, of course, talking about Keon Ellis. Now's your time. Talk to me about the timely play of Keon Ellis.
Well, I was just looking on a deal of the NBA power ratings, and then of course had the Kings, I think, at 13th. But they mentioned, and I thought it was interesting, how Keon, the team is 8-1 with Keon Ellis starting. And they're also a plus 13.3 points per 100 possessions with Keon Ellis and Fox out there together. Now, you know, you don't have to be a basketball genius to figure out that's good.
Yeah,
that's good. And so, yeah, Keon has made this team better. He's been more productive offensively than I think most of us expected. And his defense certainly has aided in so many ways. I think as much as anything, he's a guy that can switch and play guys on the switch. And I mean, that's where he's got advantage on Davion. He's not really better on the ball, but he's better when he has to switch, and gives the Kings, you know, the chances also to play more zone, which I've been begging like a little beggar all year long for that. And it seems to help. And he's really good in that. So, hey, he's a Kings have been looking for a dog. I believe they got a little dog in there with some bark.
Yeah. Tony, what about you? What do you think about Keon Ellis' play of late?
Yeah, again, you hate to see Kevin Herter go down, but this has transformed the Kings to me in such a way that I'm more excited to watch them play every night. I'm more excited for their playoff hopes. It's just a different team. For as long, the Kings have been a good basketball team for 2 seasons. And for most of those 2 seasons, they've had the same starting lineup. And never has anyone in that starting lineup been placed there for defense. This is the first time the good Sacramento Kings have had a defensive player in their starting lineup. So it's just a different dynamic for this team across the board to me. He's getting better every night, it seems like. Offensively, he's getting more confidence. And it's great to see. The offense to me is still a bonus, though, because he's just been such a game changer. Defensively, I mean, all the defensive numbers are so good, they're almost silly because the sample size is so small. But I pulled some stuff up for Keon Ellis. You know, he's 8-1 with him as a starter against the Magic last night. One of the biggest games of the year for the Kings. Mike Brown isn't just trusting him, but he's on the floor for 36 minutes in a must-win game, 19.6 assists, 5 rebounds. Since March, they're 4th in defensive rating, 4th in net rating. And that's with opponents still shooting a shit ton of free throws against the Kings because they are fouling a ton. So there's room for that the defensive metrics to get even better if they can stop fouling so much and sending teams to the line. In the last 7 games, so even crunching the sample size down even smaller, they're 2nd in defensive rating. So across the board, Keon has transformed what this team is doing defensively. And I am excited to watch them every night to see if it holds. I'm excited to watch them in the playoffs to see if they can put some stops together. I don't know how much credit to give Keon, but it seems to me like an awfully lot since that's the biggest change they've made.
You know, too, I want to add one thing I think about Kevin Herter. If, you know, obviously you're not sure you can move him or whatever, but he's a player. He's an NBA player. But I've been convinced for some time, and I'd certainly be interested in a lot of the Kings Herald people tell me how, or I'm right or wrong or out of touch. But I really think with in this team, he could play, should play a lot more at small forward anyway, because then you, when you go small and you move Keegan to four, you really are can score the ball. And I think where he'd be, he'd certainly is not a good defender against threes, but he's not a good defender against twos. So, and he rebounds quite well for his position. So, and he'd be tougher to cover for three guys, for small forwards, than guards. Guards can cover him much easier. So anyway, I think there's a real value there. Not saying it's, you know, it precludes all, but I just think there's a way to utilize him better. And, you know, and I think with Keon playing like he is, and certainly with Malik, there's how many guard minutes are there? So, you know, the old saying, I mean, get your best players on the floor, but find a way to utilize every talent you have. And I think this would be a way.
Tony mentioned being excited to see if it holds. Is Keon Ellis a starting guard long-term for the Kings, or is some of this success a lack of scouting just because he's kind of new and been thrown into the fire recently?
Well, I there's reason to believe he is. You know, I mean, you can't really project the future. I mean, he's got to continue to get better. But I always think of so many guys that are really good players now that nobody saw it coming. You know, Jimmy Butler's, for instance, or like with Boston, Derek White. Mm-hmm. That guy's terrific. You know, he's an all-star level player that was there, but he just kept getting better. Grayson Allen, who saw that coming? Guy's best shooter in the league. So what it tells me is, if okay, he's met so far his challenges, and he's clearly belongs in the NBA and playing minutes now, how much and how much better he gets. But I see no reason, you know, no reason at all why he can't be a very productive starting player in this league. And if he's not good enough to start and continues to improve, that means you're pretty darn good. You know,
Tony, anything that you see that spells out that he may or may not be a long-term success as shooting guard for the Kings?
I'm optimistic so far. If there's one point where I could say, hey, I want to watch more of this, it's his offense, because we've seen Mike Brown not play players who are only defenders. Like, you got to give him some offense too. You have to be guardable, or the teams have to guard you. And I don't think they're necessarily guarding Keon right now, and it's okay because he's making them pay and hitting shots. But I'd be interested to see how this looks if teams actually start guarding Keon with some intent, and if those threes keep falling. And if he can do that, then the Kings might have themselves a pretty good starting role player too on their hands. But I'll be watching his offense, because I'm pretty confident that his defense is NBA caliber. He's done enough of that, and it's been so electric that I'm very confident about his defensive abilities. But I'll be curious if the offense kind of holds, if there's one point to kind of watch here.
You know, one advantage he has, I think, from the offensive standpoint, really the Kings have probably three guys that have to be doubled at times. Certainly Sabonis and Fox draw a lot of double teams. And then Monk, when he comes in, you know, a normal Monk game, not the one he had last game. They might actually, what he was doing last game, they might not allow anybody to guard him. But, the point's that, I mean, I just think if he can continue to make open shots at a reasonable rate, you know, and he certainly seems to have the courage to take shots. You know, he doesn't have to be a 15-point scorer. You know, I mean, he can be a guy go out there and get you 10 points a game, and like you say, Tony, that you can't leave. You can't give him shots. That's what you can't have. You got to have somebody that, you know, if you want to double Domas low, you're going to leave him open, he's going to hurt you. That's what you need.
Just to back up your guys' points, in the last seven games, he's shooting 53.7% from the field, 44% from three on just about four attempts, scoring 8 points a game. So I feel like, Jerry, that's kind of right in the wheelhouse of what you're talking about, right?
It's exactly it. You know, I mean, and certainly you could see those percentages go down, which they probably would, and maybe the but still maybe score a few more points, which I think that'll happen too. I think he could be easily a 11 or 12 point a game scorer, and that's plenty.
Yeah.
You know, at a productive rate, you know, getting the 12 points on 9 shots or something, that's what you're looking for. And so far, there's no reason to believe he can't be that.
So we'll switch back to the subject of defense here, just so I can talk about it. The Kings have had the best defensive rating in the league since the day of our last podcast with a 105 defensive rating. I'd like to put a lot of this on Keon just because he's kind of the big change, but Is this finding a defensive anchor in Keon? Does that explain the sudden jump in defensive rating, or is there something else going on here with the Kings that could better explain this massive jump in defensive rating the last couple of weeks?
Well, I think there, you know, that's a big part of it. You know, he's a guy that does bring some dog into kind of a dogless situation, and I think that carries over. But the effort has been good. I mean, De'Aaron Fox is a much better defender than last year. Keegan Murray's a much better defender than last year. I think Domas is. He's really not even better at the rim, but he's so much better picking up wings and really switching out when he has to and holding his ground. I mean, not a lot of centers are good at that. He's one of the best, if not the best. So I guess my feeling is, yeah, this is a much better defensive team, and they've got a ways to go. But and probably Keon Ellis is a big part of that, a big part. And when he and Fox are out there together, I can see where that, the plus on the possessions is, because those guys are quick and they bother people. You know, I mean, they both get steals and deflections and all that. I mean, you can just see guys starting to crab the ball up the floor when they get out after them. A little different.
Tony, what have you seen about the Kings the last couple of weeks defensively?
Keon is the big change here, but also, like Jerry said, Fox has improved defensively, and we've talked about Keegan Murray improving his defense all year. So now you've got three perimeter defenders, I guess, depending on where you want to call Keegan, if he's the three or the four, but three guys you can guard out on the perimeter. Pretty good. And while Sabonis has issues in the paint, it helps when your perimeter defense is stronger, obviously. And I know, everyone has made this point, but the NBA is letting teams defend a little bit more in the second half of the season. Fouls are down across the league. And I think if you're a team that is relying on your perimeter defense to kind of carry you like the Kings are, they can benefit maybe more than anyone else from the NBA calling less kind of ticky-tack on the perimeter fouls. So, and that being said, the Kings are still fouling at a very, very high rate. So, they're playing tighter with ball handlers and I would say shooters, but they're still getting up a lot of threes. But I think those factors kind of together. And then also, and this is a good thing, although maybe you'll have to subtract the Wizards game from the statement, the team does seem more focused now that we're down the stretch and the playoff, the standings are changing every morning. I'm sure they're having these conversations where every possession matters, and the Kings are playing as if there is more urgency possession to possession than they were earlier in the season. And again, I say that knowing that the Wizards shot 50% from the field and 40% from three. So, the focus can only take you so far. But the Kings have looked like a better defensive team lately.
Yeah, not to take anything away from Fox. He is second in the league in steals this season behind SGA there. But how much does it help Fox for Keon? And we saw it earlier this season with Keegan to guard the best guard on the floor, the best player on the floor sometimes. How beneficial is it for Fox to be able to guard the second or third guy down the line?
Oh, I think it's a great help. Obviously he still has to focus on his offense. I mean, the Kings need him to be really good offensively. They can't really win without it. So I think it's like anything. If you can guard the second best guy, you can take a few more chances. And Fox really does like to take chances. He's good at getting steals and deflections. So, yeah, it's just a plus all the way around. And like I say, it's one of those things I still think with Keon where you can switch and he can switch off on small forwards or big guards or point guards. That's just something you didn't really have before that could do it effectively.
Tony, how do you feel about Keon and Keegan being able to relieve some of the pressure there for Fox at the top?
It can only help. And I think especially when you get into the playoffs and you're seeing the same players every night, I know I looked at the standings today and right now Dallas would be the play-in matchup. I mean, having those options against a guy like Luka, I feel much better about than if you asked me the same question last season. And I would be wondering who the hell is going to guard Luka at all. But now you've got guys in Keegan and Keon and Fox who can all take their turns on guys like Doncic and Irving. So it's great to have options.
Okay. So now to the presumptive leading six man of the year candidate, Malik Monk. The Athletic had an article this week out about Malik's season and his pending free agency. There's some speculation from Anthony Slater that teams like the Pistons, the Sixers, the Spurs might try to spike his salary out of Sacramento's range, saying that the most that the Kings would be able to give was essentially a four-year, $78 million deal. We got a lot of basketball between now and then, but spell out for me just how important it is that the Kings retain Malik Monk this offseason.
Well, for me, the reason they need to to keep him is because they can't replace him. So that'd be like losing Fox or Domas. It's almost to that caliber. And, so he is extremely valuable. I mean, you may get lucky. You know, years ago when the Kings lost Tony Delk, who was a very valuable six man, and were able to get Bobby Jackson, who became better.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, nobody saw that coming. But it sometimes it does work that way. But I just don't see how you're going to find someone better for this team than Malik Monk. And, it just takes one team that's got cap room to really use more. And they, here's the scary part is that all these teams know exactly what the Kings could do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's the problem you got. It just takes one that can say, well, they can only pay this. So if we give him $10 million more, his agent would make him take it.
Yeah.
You know, they just would. Knowing that he'd probably take a discount to some degree to stay here, but we're not talking $8-10 million, So there's as loyal as I am to Sacramento. Somebody gives me $8 million to move to Zambezi, I'm gone.
Yeah. Tony, how do you feel about Malik Monk's situation this offseason?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think I could be more nervous about it. So I don't know how many these reports are not going to make me feel any more nervous. I'm already maxed out. This did work for Monty the last time he tried it with, I'm thinking Rashawn Holmes was a guy who we were all afraid might get a better deal in free agency. They kept him through the trade deadline on an expiring, and they were able to sign him to just about the max they could. Very similar to the Malik Monk situation where every team knew how much they could offer Holmes, and that's exactly what he got, and no one beat it. So I assume Monty thinks that that is in play here, but it never makes me feel good when the free agent you're you're threatened to lose, if he signs for the contract everyone knows you can sign him for, everyone in the league would call that a bargain. So that doesn't make me feel great about like where the Kings are positioned here. It would not take much to pay beyond what the Kings can afford. I saw someone, I think it was Aki, mentioned it last night. It might not be the worst thing. They had a terrible game against the Magic because that's a team that I know we all fear that could scoop them up in free agency. So yeah, I'm concerned that Monk will leave, but in Monty, we trust, I guess, on this one.
Yeah, you just got to. And I mean, besides the money, I think there's, with Malik, he's expressed his desire to start, to be a starter. And in my mind, if it's one of those things and, the money's close, I wouldn't have any problem saying, okay, you're a starter. Keon Ellis would be terrific coming in behind both of them. You know, that's the advantage there too, but I think it, and there's, there's teams I think that would pay the kind of money we're talking about or would be paying it to him to be a starter.
Yeah.
And so, people always say, well, six man of the year. Yeah, that'd be great. He deserves it. And I think he'll get it. But hey, like I said, other than Manu Ginobili, there's really not a guy that spent his whole career as a great six man. I mean, the all-time greats at it, John Havlicek and Kevin McHale, within two or three years, were starters and Hall of Famers. And that's, I think it's human nature. I think we all, you look back on whatever sports you played, you want to be a starter.
Sure.
And so I don't blame him. And So we'll see, but scary. Scares me to death, to be honest with you, because you can't replace that guy.
Slater mentioned the Pistons, the Sixers, the Spurs. Tony, you mentioned Orlando. Not to give Monk and his agent any ideas, but do you guys, is there any other teams that you fear or that might be a better fit for Monk long term?
Well, no, but I the Spurs scare me.
Yeah, true.
Because of the potential they have, and you know, Pop knows talent, and they've got to get more talent, and they've got who that figures to be a lot better, and you know, then there again, the Texas tax rate compared to California, you know, you make a couple of million more, and it's a lot more, 4, 5, 6 million more, so. So that scares me. Yeah, that's the team that would scare me.
Tony, what about you? Or spell out maybe why Orlando?
Yeah, I couldn't. I said I couldn't get more scared, but then Jerry started talking about tax rates. And I'm like, oh, I didn't think of that angle. That's a bad one. I don't like that either. The Spurs are the team that's always scared me the most because the fit to me makes a ton of sense for them. They have a ton of cap space. They need talent. And Monk with Wemby in the pick and roll to me is very exciting, unfortunately. So I don't know. Hopefully Pop isn't listening. I think he's not. So
we'll finish this on a high note then. So Slater quoted a Monk saying, it depends on what we do in the postseason, but I'd love to be here. I got comfortable here, made a lot of new friends, met a lot of great people. The city loves me. I love the city. So yeah, I'd love to come back. So no hope is lost here. I just wanted to speculate a little bit, get everybody's blood pressure a little bit higher. And now we can finish on a Malik Monk wants to come back.
Take it.
Okay. So we're recording this podcast right before the Monday night matchup between the Kings and Sixers. It's a game in which Domantas Sabonis could break the post-merger record of double-doubles in a row set by Kevin Love in 2011 with 53. I know this is an every podcast discussion at this point. I feel like we've talked about this 50 times already. But talk to me a little bit about the consistent excellence of Domas this season on the eve of a potential NBA record being broken.
Well, one thing about Domas, which we've talked about last year and hasn't changed, is he plays harder than any big player in the league. And he does it every night, every play. I think his production exceeds his talent, which is remarkable. And I think he's gotten better. I think his work, whether it was with Doug or whoever, but he's used his right hand better. He's developed a little more of a 15-foot shot that he'll take and a little more offense. And it's the same thing, you know, 20 points on 12 shots type stuff. I mean, good grief. That's, you know, that you can't be more productive than that. And so, yeah, whatever credit he gets, it's deserved. You know, and I know people, a lot of fans, I read everything. They say, well, until he has a good playoff, it's like, well, he's had good playoffs. He didn't have one last year. It's like, okay. But you can't take away what he's doing and what he's done on something that may not, hadn't happened yet. That's all. That's kind of like the MVP stuff. It's like the MVP's regular season award. You know, that's just the way it is. And that's the way it's always been, the way it should be. And to me, what Domas is doing is very remarkable because it's a regular season consistency of effort production, you know, and that's what we all, as fans or with coaches, you want to see consistency, somebody you can count on every night. And there's probably not a player in the league more consistent than Domas Sabonis.
How do you feel about it?
To Jerry's point, he's played 70 games this year. He's on pace to play every single game of the season. How many people play 82 games? I mean, I don't want to count it before it happens for Sabonis, but you know, 79 last season with a broken thumb, barely missed a game. How many players would have done that? So he's been everything the Kings needed him to be. And I think this is kind of a meta point or a meta conversation, but he's been everything that McNair and the organization needed him to be in the face of trading someone like Tyrese Halliburton. He's lived up to what Halliburton is doing in Indiana, which I think is important for a franchise to not have the narrative that they kind of just sold away their franchise player for like someone who's going to be here for a couple of years. So they nailed the whole thing. They signed into the extension. He's playing every night. He's putting up crazy numbers. Yeah, you can't say anything else about Sabonis other than he's delivered and then some, everything McNair and the organization wanted when they traded for him.
I did notice in one of the national things where he was considered sixth in the MVP ratings, or which of course didn't make all stars, but that's another. What are you going to do?
Speaking of that, Jerry, I'm curious. There was a lot of talk around after the All-Star game, how Cat scoring 61 right before those votes, you know, were tallied, how much that helped Cat get in over Sabonis for an All-Star bid. How much does this record help the discussion around his All-NBA team hopes right here as it's happening right near the end of the season?
I think it helps a lot. You know, I do think he's starting to get more attention nationwide. I mean, the triple doubles, the consistency, the double double record, all that. And, you know, especially when you look at who's in the same conversations, you know, I mean, it's a small group. So, yeah, I think the national media is slowly come around to, oh, he's pretty good. You know, we can't, you know, he just can't keep denying that. And so, I think it'll help, no question about it.
Tony, what about you?
I usually don't care about NBA awards. I think it would be silly. I we'll see how the Kings finish the season, but provided they finish strong, I would be pretty frustrated if Sabonis doesn't get some sort of recognition from the season that he's had. They already blew it at the All-Star break. So, you know, this is the last chance to kind of give both the Kings some credit for the season they've had and then Sabonis for what he's done over the past 2 years, really.
There's one thing that I agree with Kendrick Perkins on, which is one out of 18 million. but he said he really thought Sabonis should be strongly considered in the MVP conversations. And you know, so, which worries me, because if he thought that, no, then I don't know. I maybe have to rethink it myself.
I was just going to say, I think it was Greg that pointed out that imagine what the discussion on ESPN would be like if it was Anthony Davis who had 53 double-doubles, or if Anthony Davis or somebody from the Lakers or the Warriors, if it was Draymond Green that was about to break Kevin Love's record, and how much discussion that would be. And it annoyed Greg at the time, I believe is who said it. And it's stuck in my mind ever since. Anytime Sabonis gets a double-double, I'm like, imagine what ESPN would be saying if this were Anthony Davis right now. And that was enough for me to go, okay, now he deserves an All-NBA bid. He deserves it more than just about anyone I could think of.
Yeah, if he was in New York or Boston or L.A., Golden State, any of those huge markets, I mean, it'd be a daily big story kind of thing. Yeah. But he's not. So we're all lucky. And I just love watching him play. I mean, even when he doesn't have a great game. I just really respect somebody that really puts it all out there every night.
Okay, so we'll get into a little playoff talk here. As it stands now, as of the recording of this, obviously the Kings have a game tonight, so we'll see what it stands like in the morning. But as of tonight, the Suns are sitting at 6. The Kings and Mavs are both a half game back. The Kings in 7th over the Mavs. They both have an identical 42-29 record. The Lakers are 2.5 games back of the Kings and Mavs. The Warriors are 5 games back of the Kings and Mavs. And the Rockets suddenly have become the best team in basketball, and they're only a game back of the Warriors. Kings play the Mavs twice this week. A single win would give the Kings a tiebreaker for anything they might have over the Mavs. Mavs have won 4 of 5. How important is this matchup, this dual matchup against the Mavericks this week?
Well, I think it's about as valuable as it can be. And as you say, if you could you sweep them, and I think that's still what you want to do. You're at home, beat them twice. I mean, having said that, the Mavs are better, you know, and they like the Suns, which kind of still ticks me off a little. They got significantly better picking up P.J. Washington and Daniel Gafford. That's a better team. Yeah. And they had the offense. Now they got more rebounding and defense. And then, of course, Royce O'Neal with the Suns has been a really good pickup and a nice fit. So it makes it tougher for the Kings. But that's who they're competing against, and that's who they got to beat. And to your point about the Rockets, when they came in here and beat, hey, they're as good about anybody right now.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's amazing to me, it, with Sinjin going down, I thought they would really drop. Yeah. But, you know, it's one of those things. I think Udoka is just a terrific coach, and it has been a next man up kind of thing. And they just switched maybe from going to Sinjin as much, and Jalen Green has really started to break out. And, you know, he's always had the talent to do it, but he's doing it as a playing like a star, not just a chucker. And so anyway, I've enjoyed watching them because they guard you too. You know, they're a little they're a little bit like you know, the Pelicans. You know, they athletically they can get after you. I mean, they're not that good yet, but they're not very far away either. They're scary. If I was Golden State, I'd be wetting my pants. You know.
Yeah. Tony, what about you?
I feel the same way about Houston, to the point where I would be pretty terrified to play them in a play-in situation if I'm the Kings. You don't want to play the hot team, especially the young, hungry team that can kind of like make a statement against you. No, thank you. I don't want to see them anywhere near the Kings in the play-in. But the Mavericks games are obviously huge this week. They're at home. And I just like anytime you can give this team a very high-profile test, which this, for the Kings, this could not be more of a higher profile test for the squad. The Luka situation is still part of Sacramento's DNA. The fact that he could have been here, there's always going to be that kind of competition with Dallas. And, you know, they're directly competing in playoff seeding. You've got games at home. And we've had some of these marquee games this season with the Kings where they haven't shown up. And we've had ones where they have. But we're really getting to the end of the line here with this team, with this season. These are the games you show up and you at least compete well, and you got to win one of two. If you don't sweep, I won't blame them, because like Jerry said, the Mavericks are good. They've gotten better. They're fighting too, but you definitely can't come out and lose them both on your home floor. So very interested to see how the Kings respond against this Dallas team.
Yeah, I would be a little bit more hopeful if the Kings were playing on the road. I feel like, I don't know what it is with the Kings this season, but 13 losses at home, I would be more comfortable if this was a back-to-back in Dallas, if anything.
You know, that's what's interesting. You're right. I mean, really, the Kings' home schedule is so, it's tough teams, but they're at home. Normally, you'd say, well, they've got the advantage over all these teams because they do have more home games. But the and there's always a but, as Tony Kornheiser says. But the Kings haven't been particularly better at home than they have been on the road. But now's a good time to get that way, you know. You know, if they could really take care of business at home, they can get the sixth spot.
100%. The remaining schedule for the Kings goes as such. We play the Sixers, obviously, Monday night. The Mavericks twice. We play the Jazz, Clippers. There's a Knicks-Celtics back-to-back. The Nets, Thunder. A Pelican-Suns back-to-back. And then finally, to close out the season, the Trailblazers. How many games do the Kings have to win in that stretch for you two to feel comfortable that they're making the playoffs, or at least are at the very top of the play-in?
Oh, geez. I mean, I think they've got to get to 48. Sure. You know, they got to get to 48. That might get them sixth, but it would certainly almost guarantee, I think, seventh.
For me, I was looking at the standings, and every team, I shouldn't say every team because the Clippers are kind of floundering, but you look at the teams that they're competing with in the Western Conference, and they're winning. They're 7-3 in their last 10 every time. And I've looked at this for the last 2 or 3 weeks. Every team is 7-3 in their last 10. So to me, you got to win at least 8. And I misspoke earlier. I said the Kings have 14 games left. They have 12 games left.
12 games, right.
I think you got to win at least 8 of those. And I was going down the line like you did too, Will, with the schedule. 9 of those 12 games are all against teams that are in the play-in conversation in either conference right now. So you've only got 3 games. This is why you can't lose games like the Wizards won. You've only got 3 games left with teams that are not kind of fighting for something. So these are going to be some grueling 12 games. And to me, you got to win at least 8.
Yep. All right. So we're going to roll over to you, Tony. Let's go on to the Patreon question of the day.
Thanks, Will. On every episode of this podcast, we ask at least one question from our Kings Herald patrons. You can submit questions at patreon.com/KingsHerald or on Twitter or on the website. And any leftover question that doesn't get asked on the main show here does get asked in our Patreon exclusive Q&A that we record once a month. So if you submitted a question, you don't hear it answered on this show, check out the Patreon, and I'm sure we have answered it there. This week's question comes from Bryant West. And Bryant puts it pretty simply, who would Jerry want the Kings to play to face in the playoffs?
Whew. I'd, you know, up till recently, I'd have said the Mavericks. Yeah. You know, I really liked, you know, earlier before the trade deadline, I liked that matchup better than anybody. I'm not sure now. I mean, because I definitely think they're better. So having said that, I'm like you, Tony. I wouldn't want them to be matched up in any form with the Rockets. I just don't. Probably, you know, if they're in the play-in or whoever they got to play, I think the Lakers probably would be a team I'd pick, as much as I hate their guts. And it would just scare me to death, you know, because with LeBron, you never can count him out. But the Kings certainly have had their quickness and transition ability has really been a problem for the Lakers. So I guess I don't. They're all good. Jesus, there's just no sure things, is there? I mean, probably more teams are looking at the Kings as the team they'd like to play.
Yeah.
You know, and that's probably the reality. I think just on talent alone, when you look at the West, I think, you know, the Kings probably are one of those other teams. I'd probably say, hey, I think we got a better chance against the Kings.
Yeah.
Because they got less guys we got to focus on.
Will, does anything stand out here to you in the standings as teams you'd rather play more than others? Bryant did ask for the one team you do want to play, so I will put you on the spot and make you answer that too.
I was going to make a joke about playing the Grizzlies, Trailblazers, or Spurs, but yeah. But those are teams that I really do not want to after this season. No, absolutely not. I would not guarantee that. I'm fine with any of the top three, really. I think there's something to be said about I don't expect to win against the defending champion Nuggets, but like going back-to-back years against teams that won the championship the year before, I think that will teach De'Aaron Fox and Domantas Sabonis something. I think there's some value in like losing with honor to like the defending champs. I think out of all those, like the Clippers seem to be fading, although they've always played the Kings kind of tough. And that one, though I wouldn't hope for it, you're always kind of like one Sabonis knee to Kawhi's thigh away from winning that series. Like, you just like that team is so fragile that like last year they, you know, Kawhi tears something and hey, guess what? They can't play. If I'm on the spot, I'd say the Thunder, I mean, Chet can't really handle Sabonis as of yet. Give it a couple of years. I think Fox and SGA could match each other's output. And so it'd be kind of a role players thing. So you're expecting, you know, somebody like Keegan to step up, you know, against like a J-Dub. It's one of those games that like they're at least young enough. You could get under their skin. If you hit hard and hit fast, maybe they get scared or they don't quite know how to handle it. That's also kind of dangerous because they could be like a baby rattlesnake where it's like they're too dumb to know when to stop beating you and they're too stupid to know when they're down 3-1 or 3-2 in a series. And so they might just come back and win that. So I would take the Thunder over the Nuggets and Wolves, but even then I'm not entirely confident in that one.
Will, if the Thunder eliminate the Kings, how sad will you be? Be honest. Will you be that sad or will you be like, oh, at least the Thunder, you know?
Yeah, there would be a little bit of that. Like I would try not to be like, I told you so, but like there's a little element of that. Like I'd be like, just like, but the Kings are still my main team. The Kings are, they are still the love of my life. I would still be sad. There would be a small consolation that it was like, I'd rather die, you know, at the hands of my friend than at the hands of my enemies. And it's like, okay, like at least it was the Thunder that did it. But I'd still be pretty wrecked. Yeah, I'd be pretty wrecked.
Okay, good. To your point, I think that's why the sixth spot is so sweet, because it's probably either going to be the Thunder or the Timberwolves who are missing Karl Towns. So, and obviously you avoid the play-in. So of course the sixth spot is what you want. But I think specifically in this year in the West, if you can face the Clippers or the Thunder, two also inexperienced young playoff teams as the sixth seed and you're the Kings, that would be a great, great spot to land in.
Yeah, I agree with that. Boy, if you could, I mean, that's the danger of not being in the six is you're in the play-in and those teams in a lot of ways are scarier because you're supposed to beat them.
Yeah.
And they're hard to beat. And then I'm kind of like, I'd almost go, if I had a choice, just I'd love to be in a position where you could play the Nuggets, because everything you said, well, I mean, they're the best. They're the defending champs. You can go in there with house money and just, yeah, then you've had some success with them. And so, yeah, I think that'd be the most fun if you could get to that. Obviously, getting six doesn't get you there, but I wouldn't be scared. You know, I mean, I'd almost be more scared of you know, some of the teams in the play-in than I would the top three in the West.
Yeah.
You know, the Kings have played them well. And, you know, we know the Kings play the good teams good. That's what they do. We just can't count on them playing against the weaker teams.
I guess, too, I'd rather, like, just thinking about it, the best player and their best defender, I'd rather go up against SGA and Chet than Anthony Edwards and Rudy Gobert. Like, Anthony Edwards is one of those guys that could absolutely – he is one massive dunk away from totally flipping a series regardless of how far down they are. And Rudy Gobert is a better defender at this point than Chet, though the gap is narrow. I'd just rather the young stars that haven't quite been there. I mean, not that SGA hasn't, but more talking about Chet than more established guys like a Rudy and Anthony Edwards, who terrifies me.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say one thing too, is Domas really has had consistent success against Gobert, Jokic, and Chet Holmgren. I mean, more so than some other guys. So that's kind of, you know, it's kind of interesting there. And but I agree with the Minnesota thing. I mean, Edwards, I don't know. He guards himself, maybe, but I don't know if anybody else can.
Yeah, right. You know? Yeah. You just hope he shoots himself out of it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, he'll have, you know, it's, you know, but he's a terror.
Yeah. Like, maybe encourage him to dunk so hard he doesn't dislocate his finger this time, but he, like, breaks a wrist. Like, like, hey, maybe break the backboard and hurt yourself hard enough that, like, you got to go too, buddy. That's the only way you're beating him. Okay, Jerry, it's on to you for the Reynolds wrap-up. What you got for us today?
Well, I was thinking, now this NBA officiating, I'm getting a little down on them. You know, they got some quality officials, but to me, they have just simply got to come up with a better plan. I mean, find a way to get the best officials. You may have to train them, you know, and I'm convinced you need to go get guys who are former players, whether in NBA or college, you know, athletic, quick, you know, can get up and down, cover the floor. I mean, to me, the problem they've gotten into is too much political correctness. You know, you don't have that on the floor with players. You get the best players. Now, why won't you do the same thing for the officials? Get the best. You say you got the best, but you really don't. And it's time to change that. And if I were the Players Association, I would want to give support to that, because the game is being hurt, not only by the level of officiating, but by the lack of respect for the officials. And that doesn't help anybody. And so I think this league is at a, you know, kind of a turning point here. They really need to come to grips with this and get back to how it used to be in the 80s and 90s or whatever. I know fans think I go back there too much, but the officiating, the players didn't cry on every call and expect a confab on every call. And you just simply, you know, I think the games were officiated better and more fairly. And, you know, the big problem I see is you got with three officials, you'll have one terrific official like a Zach Zarbin, but he might have one person in his threesome that's really not any good at all. And that just throws the whole thing out of whack. And so anyway, I'd be interested in whatever, you know, I trust the Kings Heralders to see what they think about that. But I just think it's a serious problem that they've got to, you know, they've got to say, hey, we got to get the best. And we got to train the best, and we can't worry about, you know, anything else, just the best, just like teams do to get players, the best. They're not worried about anything else. So anyway, that's my thought. I feel better got it out of my system. And I mean, I, you know, I kind of take up for the refs, but I think this year has really been a step back. Yeah. And I think it's for some of those reasons, to be honest with you.
Jay, I'm curious as what your thoughts are in terms of the gambling aspect of the NBA, where gambling is becoming such a big part of sports right now. And the fact that some of these refs might be able to hide, maybe not that they were betting necessarily, but like that the refs have such an outcome on the game that the less well-trained you are, the more likely it is to be at least accused of being somebody who's betting on the side or whatnot. I wonder what you think about the referees and the way betting is kind of taking over the sport as well.
Well, you have to be concerned. I mean, as Tim Donahue proves that, you know, so there's, that's always, and that's been a problem, you know, in the college game some. I'd say it's more likely to be a problem in the college game, because you got guys that they're, you know, teachers or school principals or whatever, and they're working part-time as officials, and $20,000 for kind of controlling the score of the game. I think probably, you know, and they're not scrutinized to near the same level. So, but I think to your point, it's a real concern, obviously. And now, I mean, almost the NBA is encouraging betting on everything, you know, and in the arenas and stuff. I just think going back even 10 years to where I remember every year we'd have to take some kind of a class and fill out forms and stuff about not betting and knowing and not talking about it and stuff like that. Now it's like, geez, yeah, I don't know. It's a bad, I think it's a concern. Will, I do. I think we're going to have an issue at some point. I do. Referees, maybe even officials. I mean, people on staffs and things like that. I think that's we're in a kind of precarious position, but having said that, I think the college officials are a lot more vulnerable, you know, just because.
Yeah, it feels like one of those things that the NBA has actual proof of their refs, you know, in Tim Donahue, like betting on the side, and yet they still went all the way in the last couple of years on sports betting. That it's weird to me. It's one of those things that kind of blows my mind that they would be willing to